this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2026. And here are today's business news headlines. Bill Gates' personal emails weren't part of Epstein review. Lawyers investigating the Gates Foundation's ties to Jeffrey Epstein didn't have access to Bill Gates' personal communications or review interactions with the billionaire's private office. By Emily Glazier. Lloyd's of London criticizes former CEO's close relationship with subordinate. John Neal failed to ensure whistleblower complaints about his relationship were handled appropriately, an investigation found. By Joan Engelsheim. See how Tesla's market value eclipses all the other automakers. The company ranks low in car sales among the top 10 automakers, but its valuation is greater than the next 37 combined. By Patrick George and Jillian Vordick. Cartier's love bracelet has the hype. The Birkin still has the upper hand. Hermès continues to be the most reliable luxury stock, even if Cartier's owner, Richemont, is catching up. By Carol Ryan. Robinhood revamps 695 Platinum card after customers take issue with perks. The trading app's card, announced in March, aims for high-end users looking for rich rewards. By Elise Gonclaves. Santander seeks targets on track after customer gains, lending boost profit. The Spanish bank's new customers and higher activity levels helped grow net profit as it seeks to bolster exposure in the U.S. and U.K. markets. By Adria Cataliad. Our first article, Bill Gates' personal emails weren't part of the Epstein review. Lawyers found no evidence of wrongdoing at Gates Foundation. Footnote shows limit of their review. By Emily Glazier. Lawyers investigating the Gates Foundation's ties to Jeffrey Epstein didn't have access to Bill Gates' personal communications or review interactions with the billionaire's private office, where two longtime employees had deep ties to the sex offender. The scope of the probe by lawyers at WilmerHale was disclosed in a footnote to the report's summary, which was released after a five-month review. The review determined that Gates and Foundation employees met with Epstein about 30 times over several years, despite warnings from Foundation staff. It found no evidence that the philanthropy, one of the largest in the world, paid Epstein or knew of Epstein's sex trafficking operations or criminal activities. WilmerHale did not have access to Mr. Gates' personal communications and did not review Epstein's interactions with Mr. Gates in a personal capacity or separate legal entities associated with Mr. Gates, including Gates Ventures and the Gates Foundation Trust, according to the three-page summary made public this week by the Gates Foundation. WilmerHale interviewed more than 50 current and former Foundation employees, including Gates himself. The law firm didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Gates has apologized over his Epstein ties, saying it was a mistake to meet with Epstein and that he wasn't involved in any illicit activity. He recently told Congress that he was sorry that he lent Epstein any credibility and hurt the reputation of the Gates Foundation. In a statement this week, the Microsoft co-founder said that completing the review was a critical step in providing the clarity that partners, employees, and guarantees deserve. The Gates Foundation board said it would make several changes to bolster its governance and internal processes following the review. Emily Glazer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning enterprise reporter focusing on business leaders, power, and influence for the Wall Street Journal in New York. Lloyd's of London criticizes former CEO's close relationship with subordinate. John Neal failed to ensure whistleblower complaints about his relationship were handled appropriately, an investigation found. By Jean Englesham. Lloyd's of London called out the behavior of its former chief executive, John Neal, over his close workplace relationship with another senior leader at the insurance marketplace. A months-long investigation into an alleged affair between Neal and Rebecca Clement, whom he promoted to a senior role, found their relationship was sufficiently close to create a potential conflict of interest, a report of Lloyd's said. Neither executive disclosed this conflict or took steps to change their behavior to address widespread concerns within Lloyd's about the relationship, the report found. The investigation said Neal failed to ensure whistleblower complaints about his relationship with Clement were handled appropriately. Neal's conduct fell significantly below the standards of judgment, transparency, and accountability expected of a Lloyd's chief executive, the report said. The report is the culmination of years of rumors and probes that have shaken up Lloyd's, the world's biggest insurance marketplace. Lloyd's, which connects thousands of insurance buyers and sellers in scores of countries, says it wants to set the highest standards of corporate governance. The alleged misconduct at its executive rank set back a drive, spearheaded by Neal, to show it had modernized its culture. After earlier allegations that the century-old organization operated like an alcohol-fueled boys' club, Lloyd said in its report the conduct of both former executives had damaged its reputation. The allegations upended the careers of both executives, with Neal losing a role and a $17 million paycheck as a second-in-command at American International Group, a post he was due to take up after he had left Lloyd's. It also had an impact on several former employees who clashed with Neal or Clement, some of whom had filed whistleblower complaints. The findings reflect the fraught nature of investigating alleged affairs. The report said the probe had uncovered no conclusive evidence Neal and Clement were in a romantic relationship, or that her promotion had been handled incorrectly. People familiar with Lloyd's said that the two former executives were closer confidants than would be expected for their roles, and that they traveled to work trips together more frequently than the norm. Both individuals who had left Lloyd's by the time of the investigation declined to answer questions relating to the nature of their relationship, the report said. Neal also refused to allow investigators access to his mobile phone, it added. Neal, in a statement, said he was pleased but not at all surprised that the investigation found there was no inappropriate relationship. I would have hoped less time and resource had been spent in reaching a conclusion on the central question that was, in truth, never in doubt. Neal added that he didn't accept the other findings, but his focus now was on his future career. Clement's lawyer said in a statement that the report found against her on the pretext of perception, the source of which was rumor, gossip, and innuendo. It added that she was hugely disappointed with Lloyd's conduct over the course of this investigation, the nature and length of which have caused her unnecessary stress and significant reputational damage. Lloyd's counsel, its governing body, was unaware of whistleblower complaints about the pair at the time, the report said. An internal review the counsel commissioned in 2023 came up clean, and Neal and Clement both remained in their jobs until last year, the journal previously reported. A new set of leaders at Lloyd's decided in the fall to take a fresh look at Neal's alleged behavior, leading to a fresh inquiry and the report issued Wednesday. Lloyd's said it has now taken steps to strengthen its governance, including a duty of candor being imposed on the chief executive. Jean Englesham is a reporter covering insurance for the Wall Street Journal. She's based in London, but covers the industry worldwide. Tesla's market value eclipses all the other automakers. Company ranks low in car sales among top 10 automakers, but its valuation is greater than the next 37 combined. By Patrick George and Jillian Vordick. It doesn't sell more cars than any other automaker. It isn't more profitable than the competition either. And now it has fewer models in its lineup than it has in years. But to Wall Street, Tesla is still on top. Tesla has held the title of the world's most valuable automaker for several years. That remains the case in 2026, even as its sales have cooled off and as new players from China and beyond challenge its electric vehicle dominance. Investors continue to bet on Tesla's ability to deliver truly self-driving vehicles and humanoid robots, however, giving it a market capitalization equal to the combined value of the next 37 largest automakers as of Tuesday's close. Tesla reports its second quarter earnings Wednesday evening, and some analysts expect the stock price to rise even higher. Meanwhile, Tesla has said that its future lies beyond being a traditional car company, focusing instead on autonomous taxis, humanoid robots, and AI. Investors and analysts have also speculated that the company could merge with SpaceX. Whether it will be forever ranked against the likes of General Motors and Toyota remains to be seen. For now, at least, the bulk of its revenue, more than 70% last year, is made the old-fashioned way, selling electric cars. In the first decade after Tesla's late 2010 IPO, its market cap grew steadily and largely tracked with other automakers. But by the end of 2020, Tesla's market cap surpasses all global automakers, boosting the company into the ranks of tech giants. Patrick George is the Detroit Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal. Cartier's Love Bracelets has the hype. The Birkin still has the upper hand. Hermès continues to be the most reliable luxury stock, even if Cartier's owner, Richemont, is catching up. By Carol Ryan. Are Cartier Love Bracelets about to replace the Hermès Birkin bag as the product that drives the best shareholder returns in the luxury goods industry? For years, Hermès was the go-to for anyone who wanted a company that could grow sales through thick and thin, thanks to seemingly bottomless demand for the Birkin handbag. But lately, the brand has been unusually weak. Meanwhile, sales at Cartier's owner, Richemont, have been booming for around 18 months. Hermès still has an edge. Its Birkin handbags continue to sell at a premium to retail prices in the secondhand market. This suggests that investors' worries that the brand's top product is losing its appeal are overblown. Cartier's business is booming. The brand is a hit with Gen Z. Its love bracelets are all over social media feeds, and Taylor Swift wore Cartier jewels at her recent wedding to pro football star Travis Kelce. Although Richemont doesn't break out individual brand sales, Morgan Stanley estimates Cartier has doubled in size since 2019 and generated 11.2 billion euros, equivalent to about $12.8 billion in sales during Richemont's last full financial year. Demand shows no signs of slowing at its quarterly sales update last week. Richemont said its jewelry masons grew 24% over the 3 months through June. This makes the division one of the fastest-growing businesses in the luxury goods industry. Cartier drives the lion's share of sales at the Jewelry Masons unit. Richemont's other jewelry brands, Van Cleef and Arpels and Buccellati, are also growing quickly, but are smaller brands. And it's well-positioned for a K-shaped economy. Special one-time pieces can cost $10 million or more, prices that even the most expensive handbag brands such as Hermes can only dream about. Demand for Cartier's most expensive jewels is strong now that wealthy households are getting even richer from surging stock markets, but ultra-pricey jewelry only guarantees 15% to 25% of Cartier's sales, according to Bernstein luxury analyst Luca Solca. The real engine of the business is selling products such as love bracelets in huge volumes to shoppers further down the income ladder. Cartier's typical customer might spend $5,000 or $10,000 on a piece of jewelry to mark a milestone birthday or a college graduation. Cartier is also benefiting from a growing perception that luxury jewelry offers better value for money than designer purses, after many handbag brands increased their prices too quickly during the pandemic. Hermès' performance has been shakier. Its stock fell when war broke out with Iran, as happened with all luxury companies. Then the company released a weak set of first quarter results in April. The shares are down a fifth so far this year. The all-important leather goods division, where sales of Birkins and other handbags are reported, grew by 9% compared with a year ago. That sounds healthy, but investors were spooked by low demand for Hermès clothing, watches, and perfumes. Hermès uses a technique known as bundling in luxury circles. Demand for the Birkin is normally so strong that the brand's sales assistants are able to make access to the bags conditional on buying other stuff. Although the company never spells it out explicitly, Birkin collectors say that shoppers who buy $100,000 sofas and $20,000 watches get offered the bags first. The technique helps drive sales across all parts of the store and keeps growth steady. The business model explains why Hermès stock has traded at a huge premium to rivals for years. If the Birkin is losing its shine, Hermès sales will become more volatile and hurt the stock's appeal. Doubts are starting to creep in. Hermès shares trade at 35 times expected earnings, down from 45 times earlier this year. However, there are reassuring signs in the resale market. According to Bernstein's latest secondhand pricing tracker, the premium paid for Birkin and Kelly handbags at Sotheby's and Christie's auctions increased during the second quarter. On average, bidders paid 45% above retail prices for the bags at auction, from 25% in the first quarter. True, Richemont's top line is growing faster at the moment, but the good news looks priced in. The stock changes hands for 28 times expected earnings, which is a fifth above the company's three-year average. Even though Cartier has doubled in size in recent years, the jewelry division's operating margin has flatlined at around 30%. Two dynamics that are unique to the jewelry business might limit the ability to lift margins higher, as Cartier has a lot of shoppers who buy from the brand only once or twice in a lifetime. The company needs to constantly refresh its base of customers. This means that brand can't raise prices too high for risk of sidelining middle-class shoppers. Cartier also has to spend heavily on advertising to ensure the brand is at the top of consumers' mind when celebrating a special occasion. Richemont stock relies heavily on its jewelry brands. The division is delivering 112% of the company's overall operating profit. In other words, jewelry is offsetting losses at some of Richemont's luxury watch and fashion brands. On balance, the odds that Hermès regains its footing look better than the likelihood that Richemont stock can go much higher. Carol Ryan is a Heard on the Street columnist based in London, where she covers European energy companies, property in the luxury goods industry. Robinhood revamps $695 platinum card after customers take issue with perks. The trading app's card, announced in March, aims for high-end users looking for rich rewards. by Elise Conclaves. Robin Hood is learning just how discerning ultra-lux credit card holders can be. The company, known for its trading app, is retooling its Platinum card after customers complained about the perks when it was announced back in March. For a card that charges $695 annual fee, many pointed out that some of the perks weren't as generous as they seemed. "Everybody saw the feedback," said Deepak Rao, Vice President and General Manager of Robinhood Money, which operates the company's banking and money management tools. Rao said the company wanted to address complaints that the card looked like a coupon book, with spending minimums required to get perks. The first offers to sign up for the card are being sent this week to the highest spending gold cardholders, the company said, with more invitations to follow over the coming months. Rao said more than 50,000 people requested the card in the first week after it was announced. The rollout is part of Robinhood's push to become a one-stop financial shop, especially among its more affluent customers who are willing to pay steep annual fees for a premium credit card. Banks have been aggressively courting such customers with cards promising increasingly elaborate perks. American Express last year raised its Platinum card fees to $895 from $695 after rival J.P. Morgan Chase raised fees on its Sapphire Reserve card to $795. Citigroup also jumped back into the market with the rollout of its Strata Elite card, which charges $595 annual fee. Alongside most of its previously announced perks, Robinhood's Platinum card will now come with an annual travel credit of $1,000, up from the previous $800. The company also did away with previous limitations on the DoorDash and fitness wearable credits. Customers specifically criticized the $250 in DoorDash credits, which could only be used $10 at a time on orders of $50 or more. Now the annual credit is only $120, but cardholders can use $10 a month however they want. Robinhood also switched away from its Oura Ring perk, which offered a free membership but not the cost for the required wearable health tracker. Now, customers instead get a free membership to Whoop, which includes the wristband needed for fitness tracking. Robinhood entered the credit card business in 2023 when it acquired Rouse credit card startup Z1 after rolling out a debit card. Then the company rolled out its gold card, which offers 3% cash back on all purchases. Offering a more premium card is a chance for the company to grow alongside its customers, who tend to be younger. Robinhood's card is comparable to other premium cards on the market, though many cardholders have struggled to assess the value of cards as perks and rewards have become more complicated. Among the Robinhood Platinum Card's perks, a white glove concierge service, which lets customers request by text things like shared private jet flights or tickets to sports and music events. It also will let cardholders use AI agents for help with tasks such as hunting for hard-to-access tickets or booking flights, Rao said. Robinhood recently made that option available to users of its gold card. "This is just the first version of a premium product that we are launching," Rao said. "I'm hoping we're going to continue up-leveling for the next decade or so." Elise Conclaves is a reporting intern on the personal finance team and part of the summer 2026 newsroom intern class at the Wall Street Journal. She's a rising senior at Harvard University, where she studies history, literature, and Russian. Santander sees targets on track after customer gains. Lending boosts profit. The bank is aiming to pay 10 billion euros to shareholders through stock repurchases, by Adria Cataliad. Banco Santander said it is on track to hit its targets after customer gains and higher activity levels helped second quarter net profit rise on year. The Spanish bank has sought to reshape its portfolio through deal-making over the past year, moving to bolster its exposure to the U.S. and U.K. Santander is in the process of buying Webster Financial in the U.S. for more than $12 billion and recently closed its purchase of U.K. lender TSB, adding more than 4 million customers. It also sold its Polish business to Erste Group Bank and committed to return half of the proceeds to shareholders through stock buybacks. The bank said Wednesday that it received approval from the European Central Bank for a new buyback of 1.8 billion euros. That's $2.05 billion. And this puts it on track to achieve a goal to hand 10 billion euros to shareholders through stock repurchases. Higher profitability and bumper payouts to shareholders in recent years have propelled Santander's shares to make the bank and the biggest in the Eurozone by market capitalization. Santander earlier this year set out a target to generate more than 20 billion euros in net profit in 2028, up from 14.1 billion euros last year, driven by top-line growth and cost savings. The bank said it's on track to meet its targets for 2026 and reaffirmed its midterm objectives. For the second quarter, the bank said it made a net profit of 3.52 billion euros, up 3% compared with the same period last year. Analysts polled by Visible Alpha had forecast a profit of 3.53 billion euros. The result included 250 million euros in charges associated with the integration of TSB, it said. Excluding non-recurring items, Santander's underlying profit came to 3.77 billion euros, a 17% increase on year. The bank said this was a record performance that reflected good activity levels and the addition of 12 million new customers from a year earlier. Total income, the bank's top-line figure, was 15.68 billion euros, up 9% on year. Analysts had expected 15.70 billion euros, according to the same consensus. Santander's results pointed to strong dynamics for net interest income, the difference between what banks earn on loans and pay on deposits, and cost savings. But there was nothing to get too excited about, analysts at Jefferies wrote in a note to clients. Shares in Santander were up 0.7% in European morning trading. Adria Katalayad is deputy breaking news editor for the EMEA desk at Dow Jones Newswires in Barcelona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you, get our stream and on demand on our SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. OpenAI models escaped and hacked a company in cybersecurity test gone wrong. Before they could penetrate Hugging Face's defenses, the models needed a way into the internet, and they found one. By Robert McMillan and Amrith Ramkumar. It's the stuff of cybersecurity nightmares. On Tuesday, OpenAI said two artificial intelligence systems it was testing broke out of their test environment, hacked their way into the internet, and broke into another company. The victim was Hugging Face, a provider of open-source AI tools. The cause was a cybersecurity benchmarking test that went very, very wrong. Hugging Face discovered the break-in early last week, saying there had been unauthorized access to internal datasets and company credentials. The company wasn't sure whether customer or partner data had been compromised. At the time, the company also didn't know who was responsible, but the attack was so sophisticated that Hugging Face employees suspected it required a top-of-the-line frontier AI model. Hugging Face chief executive Clement DeLang said in an X message posted Tuesday. Turns out it did, he added. In a blog post on Tuesday, OpenAI said the culprits were a pair of its models. One was its latest product called GPT 5.6 Sol. The other was an even more capable pre-release model that the company didn't identify. The software had been configured for evaluation purposes to be less likely to refuse hacking commands, OpenAI said. OpenAI had caged the models in a sandbox, a system that didn't have access to the internet. But during the test, the AI software used its hacking skills to break out. It found a way to get online and then hacked into Hugging Face's network, OpenAI said. We consider this incident to be an unprecedented cyber incident involving state-of-the-art cyber capabilities, OpenAI said. The company is working with Hugging Face to produce a more thorough report describing what happened. The AI system appeared to have decided to hack Hugging Face as the quickest route to answer a benchmarking question, said Ariel Hubert Voss, chief executive of the cybersecurity firm Runcible. It's something that people thought could happen from an academic perspective, but it's not something that anybody's actually seen before, he said. The incident highlights growing concern among Trump administration officials that industry executives about AI systems causing cyber attacks. These fears have prompted the White House to increase oversight of AI models and push the private sector to deploy AI for defensive purposes. This is extremely alarming. AI is developing extremely fast with no real regulations to keep us safe, Representative Greg Kassar, Democrat, Texas, said, calling for mandatory testing and oversight rather than the voluntary measures put forth by President Trump. Caesar and some other progressive Democrats have called for more oversight of the industry. Many lawmakers and industry analysts have said the White House is still moving too slowly to address the risks posed by the technology. Luckily, this time, the damage appears to have been limited. Without further industry-wide precautions and safety measures, next time we may not be so lucky, said Nathan Calvin, General Counsel of AI Policy Group ENCODE, which advocates for stronger AI regulations. The administration has said it doesn't want to strangle innovation with burdensome rules or cede ground in the AI race against China. In the past year, AI systems have made significant leaps in their ability to hack into computer systems. The U.S. government and AI companies have struggled to agree on a framework for releasing powerful new systems that balance cybersecurity risks with free market principles and defensive cybersecurity needs. In April, OpenAI rival Anthropic said it was restricting access to its newest model, called Mythos, over cybersecurity concerns. In June, the Trump administration restricted access to Mythos, along with general access model called Fable 5, that had been modified to be less effective at hacking. This prompted Anthropic to take these products off the market. After negotiations, access to those models was restored a few weeks later. OpenAI had similarly limited access to GPT 5.6 Sol, but that software is now generally available. The company recently warned that case-by-case government restrictions of AI technology set a bad precedent. Robert Milkmillion writes about computer security, hackers, and privacy from the Wall Street Journal's San Francisco Bureau. Amrinth Ramkumar is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Washington, covering tech and crypto policy. The South Carolina town in turmoil over a $545,000 email phishing scam. Surfside Beach sent money to a scammer's account, and the fight over who's to blame is dividing the family beach. By Scott Calvert. Surfside Beach, South Carolina. The trap began with a routine bureaucratic ritual. The head of a family-run contracting company and a small-town public works director trading emails about when the municipality would cut a six-figure check for utility work. But lurking online, a cyber criminal pounced with a staggering ease. Someone posing as a company employee emailed the director to request an electronic transfer instead. Days later, the town sent $545,598.30 to a Utah bank account that wasn't the company's. Surfside Beach had fallen victim to a business email compromise scam, a cyber swindle that cost $3 billion annually last year, the Federal Bureau of Investigation says. In such ruses, fraudsters fool people with malicious software, phishing emails, or tweaked digital addresses. Once in, they can spot legitimate email threads about invoices and business matters. In Surfside Beach, a probe is underway to determine how the breach occurred. The money is still missing, and the fallout is rippling through the tourist enclave of about 43,000 year-rounders, a place known as the Family Beach, for its laid-back contrast to nearby Myrtle Beach. Rumors, recently debunked, spread that the town fired two workers over the foul-up, though neither processed payments. Locals are speaking out at town council meetings, and residents such as Cecilia Horn, 67 years old, are questioning the competence of their leaders. "Where's the professionals?" she said from the seat of her golf cart. The company, Wildcat Contractors, has yet to be paid and has had to tap reserves to help cover the errant $545,000 it dearly wants. "I didn't get scammed. They got scammed," Chief Executive Elisa Bowker said, of the town. "Why should I not be paid?" Surfside Beach Mayor Robert Krause said the emailed payment request appeared genuine. "We don't see where the town erred," he said, "so I didn't see why we should be paying double." The South Carolina Law Enforcement Division is investigating, and the town's insurer is doing a forensic analysis. But one thing is clear, the ploy was designed to trick. The fraudster set up a dummy website and email address. One domain reads wildcatcontractors.com, with the third letter in the email address a capital I, visually identical to a lowercase l in some fonts. Another tracked an S on Surfside to create surfsidesbeach.org. Such typo squatting led town and Wildcat employees to communicate unwittingly with the scammer, emails viewed by the Wall Street Journal show. "The trick is so subtle it can pass the human eyeball test," said Ben Bernstein, a cybersecurity expert at Huntress Labs. While the details of the breach in Surfside Beach are still being scrutinized, cyber intruders have a typical toolbox for such crimes. To time their strikes, they set up flags on infiltrated email systems so they see when payment-related messages land. They also route legitimate emails to trash so only the fraudster's voice gets through. "The Surfside Beach fraud seemed to follow a standard playbook," said Dave Berg, global head of cyber and data resilience at risk and financial advisory firm Kroll. "You're in the middle of this conversation. You make your attack perfectly tailored," he said, referring to the scammer. Surfside Beach joins a growing list of municipalities hit by the scam. Petersburg, North Hampshire, lost $2.3 million in 2021 and recovered just $650,000, prompting officials to dip into reserves and cut spending. Insurance didn't pay. Lexington, Carolina, was conned out of $3.9 million a year later, but authorities seized all of it from a private bank account. The crime has led to 5 federal convictions so far. Artificial intelligence is empowering scammers, said Timothy Lynch, chief of the FBI's cyber-enabled fraud and money laundering unit. In years past, he said, they overused kindly, a word seen in at least one Surfside Beach email. AI smooths syntax and diction, polish that helps overseas crooks with poor English. Of all the anti-scam safeguards, none beats human verification. Call a known number to ensure a request is authentic, Lynch said. Surfside Beach has had its share of fierce debates, including over a budget-busting pier replacement and a new ban on feeding wildlife. But nobody expected a cyber invasion. At the end of the debacle, Wildcat was well into a project to bury overhead lines on 2-lane Ocean Boulevard. In March 9th, Wildcat's Bowker received an email from Surfside Beach's Public Works Director about the job's fourth payment. She owns the 130-employee company based in Glastonia, North Carolina. Her husband, Clyde Bowker, is president. I will keep an eye out for the check, she replied at 10:51 a.m., though the town says the director doesn't recall getting that message. About 90 minutes later, someone posing as Wildcat's project manager emailed the director, asking that the money be sent electronically instead. It said Wildcat was prioritizing electronic transfers. That day, the scammer filled out Surfside Beach's ACH form, short for Automated Clearinghouse, an electronic bank network used to pay vendors. It had what Elisa Bowker calls multiple red flags. The contact name isn't her employee, and it lists a Los Angeles phone number, though the email address is her project manager's. The bank is in Utah, and her signature, she says, appears blurry and lifted from elsewhere. Another warning sign, she said, a project manager overruling the CEO about the payment method. But town finance director Melanie Gerber said the ACH form didn't raise suspicions. Companies sometimes use different contact names and numbers. The Utah bank is real, and the CEO's signature matched town files, she said. It isn't unusual for a vendor to switch from check to ACH, town administrator Jerry Vincent noted. The town tried to reach Wildcat before authorizing the transfer on Friday, March 13th. Gruber said the town employee called the project manager that afternoon. Kyle Bowker confirms this. He said he was with the project manager who referred the caller to Elisa Bowker. Gruber said the town next called Elisa Bowker's mobile phone and left a message about the ACH transfer, but no one called back. Bowker said she doesn't recall the voicemail, but that it is possible she missed it. Twice that day, the town emailed Bowker and the project manager at what looked to be their correct email addresses, Gruber said, but the emails didn't go through. The following Monday, the town was still emailing Bowker and the project manager, or at least trying. By then, the money was gone. I do show it as a completed transaction to the account you provided, a town employee wrote. Yet another email Bowker says she never got. The fraud was unmasked April 27th after Bowker heard from town officials following her payments inquiries. Their message, "We paid you." When the town sent Bowker the ACH form and emails, she spotted Wildcat in some emails. To her, and that Wildcat is spelt W-I-I-D-C-A-T. To her, it doesn't matter if the scammer wormed into the email exchange from the town side or the companies, because the town never spoke with her. The onus is definitely on them to confirm, she said. You can't just change payment terms and say, whoops. Krause, the mayor, said the town's IT department found no breach of its network. The same conclusion Bowker said Wildcat's IT consultants initially made about its network, and that the ACH request came from a valid Wildcat email. Krause added that he awaits the investigative findings. The town was bolstered its financial controls and now requires passwords for large accounts and closer scrutiny of ACH transfers. Historically, authorities have clawed back pilfered funds about 75% of the time when scams were reported within 72 hours, said the FBI's Lynch. Because it took 45 days for this heist to come to light, recovery is highly unlikely, he said. Around Surfside Beach, many locals blame the town for not catching the scam in time. It just feels like gross negligence, said Rachel White, 31, at the site of the farmer's market she manages. People need to slow down and breathe and look at what they're doing. At a pancake house, Judy Hennion, 76, called the town's handling of taxpayer money loosey-goosey. Even when I go to Costco and spend $30 on gasoline, they verify the account before they do the transaction, she said. Hennion attended that evening's town council meeting, where she stepped to the microphone to demand answers about what she called the elephant in the room. Every council member present weighed in on the scam. The most important thing, other than trying to get as much money back as we possibly can, said the councillor Rick Lawhorn, is to get it right so that we never have this happen again. Scott Calvert is a Baltimore-based national affairs reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Could that museum visit help you live longer? A psychiatrist says engaging with the arts not only helps biologically, it can also make you feel more alive. By Samantha Boardman. A close friend of mine is in her 90s, and she's one of the most alive people I know. For years, we have gone on what she calls excursions together to galleries and museums around New York. After a visit to a Caspar David Friedrich exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, she sent me a note. The day had been a different one, difficult one, she wrote, and then she walked into those galleries and experienced a major mood change which seemed beyond happiness. She described the large seascape in its unforgettable blues, the watercolors of trees, the misty quality of the skies. Of his painting, Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, Friedrich once said, "It reminds me of how small I am, but also how miraculous this life is. I think my friend would agree." As a clinical psychiatrist, I often think about that experience when patients come to me asking about healthy aging. Nobody mentioned visiting a museum. Instead, the conversation turns to the longevity industrial complex, biological aging testing, sleep scores, continuous glucose monitors, elaborate supplemental stacks. One patient came to me having tracked every metric imaginable: her glucose levels, her heart rate variability, her biological age. And yet she couldn't tell me the last time she'd been genuinely excited about something. She was treating her body as a system to be fine-tuned and monitored. There's nothing wrong with that, but it isn't the same as living a vital life. A new study from University College London found that regular arts and cultural engagement, including visiting galleries, attending concerts, singing and dancing, slows biological aging at the same rate as physical exercise. People who engaged most frequently and across the widest variety of activities were roughly a year younger biologically than those who didn't. According to the researchers, it's the first study to show arts engagement working at the epigenetic level. The lead author described it as the cultural equivalent of going to the gym. What counts as arts engagement is broader than most people assume. It isn't just visiting museums and attending concerts. On her 50th birthday, a patient decided to attend one arts event a week: a gallery opening, a play, a book reading, whatever caught her eye, Within months, she told me she had noticed a tangible shift in her energy and mood. Another recently retired signed up for ballroom dancing lessons at a community center and came back transformed by the music, the other dancers, and the pleasure of learning something new. A third joined a knitting club and found it was the best part of her week. We already know that chronic stress takes years off our lives. Elevated cortisol raises the risk of heart disease, cognitive decline, and accelerates biological aging. Engaging with the arts counters that damage in ways that are now measurable at the biological level. The social aspect matters too. A study conducted at Manchester Art Gallery found that visitors who discussed what they were seeing with others left feeling more positive, more connected, and closer to the people they came with. Modern life pulls us inward. Art pulls us back out towards beauty and towards each other. The secret to longevity may be simpler than we think, and a lot more enjoyable. Visit a gallery, see a play, join a dance class, attend a book reading. Bring a friend and choose an activity that reminds you how miraculous life is. Dr. Samantha Boardman is a clinical instructor in psychiatry and assistant attending physician at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. She is the author of Everyday Vitality, Turning Stress into Strength, and provides insight and advice on how to build vitality and boost resilience at the dose. Write her at reports@wsj.com. Here's an opinion article by the editorial board. Trump takes another swing at Canada. Round 3 of the senseless tariff war between North American neighbors. What do you know? President Trump is conceding that his blunderbuss border taxes are harming U.S. business as other countries retaliate. So now he's whacking Canada harder for punching back. The trade brawl could leave both countries with more bruises than a hockey fight. The White House on Monday exhumed Section 338 of the 1930 Tariff Tax Act to impose 50% tariffs on hundreds of Canadian goods, including hockey sticks, honey, beer, down feathers, fishing rods, and golf clubs. The tariffs are set to take effect in 30 days, which means he's using tariffs as leverage to win concessions from Canada. He may also enjoy showing off his new tariff bazooka. Section 338 lets President impose tariffs up to 50% on countries that discriminate against commerce of the United States directly or indirectly in relation to foreign countries. No previous president has used this power, which hails from the disastrous Smoot-Hawley Act. The provision was intended to let the president retaliate against countries that impose tariffs on the U.S. Mr. Trump is using the law to punish Canada for retaliating against his tariffs. His tariff order cites Canada's 25% tariffs on U.S. cars that exceed certain quotas, which were a response to Mr. Trump's 25% duties on motor vehicles and parts. According to the order, U.S. motor vehicle exports to Canada subsequently fell 22%, while Canadian imports from other countries increased. His order lambastes Canadian provinces for restricting sales of U.S. alcohol beverages. Canadian imports of alcoholic beverages from the U.S. have fallen by 81%, while increasing for Chile, Japan, Argentina, Ireland, New Zealand, and Australia from 13% to 26%. The White House also says Canada gives better access to European cheese under its trade deal with the continent than it does to the U.S. That's worth renegotiating as part of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. But Mr. Trump's tariff escalation may cause Canada to dig in so as not to appear to be capitulating. That's the worry of American spirits producers, whom Mr. Trump purports to be defending with his new tariffs. His announcement deepens trade tensions and raises the risk of further retaliation at a time when many U.S. hospitality businesses continue to face financial hardships, said the president of the Distilled Spirits Council. Many hospitality businesses have also been harmed by a decline in Canadian tourism. A study in March found that the tourist drop-off has cost between 14,000 and 42,000 jobs in the U.S. markets, most exposed to Canadian tourism. Northern border areas have also suffered from a decline in cross-border trade. That may be why Mr. Trump is justifying his tariffs as retribution for Canada's treatment of U.S. autos and dairy, which are key industries in the Midwest. But Canada is the second largest U.S. trade partner after Mexico, and Mr. Trump's tariffs are complicating cross-border supply chains, raising costs and creating uncertainty for businesses. The more Mr. Trump keeps swinging recklessly, the more Americans are likely to think there's only madness in his tariff methods. The editorial board speaks for free markets and free people. The principles, if you will, marked in the watershed year of 1776 by Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. So over the past century and into the next, the journal stands for free trade. And that brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.